This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Well, it is. It's time for Radio Unnameable. I'd like to begin by saying good morning, Cabal. As I said, my name is Fast. That's Bill over there. And I've been thinking of changing his appellation to Bill of Rights. I think that is more appropriate. Although unpaid Bill is true, and I'm unpaid Bob, we are here for completely incomprehensible reasons in this culture. As a matter of fact, in this station, because although I get something like respect in some parts of the media world, at home here at WBAI, I wouldn't say I get anything like the pretended awe that some people exhibit. I'm not quite sure what we're going to do this morning, Bill and I. I have a big variety of recorded materials that I wanted to play. I wanted to maybe say something about a couple of the wonderful people who have passed recently into the reward, at least, of our dear memory. I'm not sure I'm going to mention all of their names, but I'll try to play something that brings them to mind.
When I'm gone,
No, that whole theme is not not too depressing, actually. Kate McGarrigle going and Howard Zinn. Oh, I don't think that's what you want to hear tonight, is it, Cabal? I don't know. Maybe it is, maybe not. I know what I would like to do, at least at this moment I would, despite the fact that my voice is just, it's not here at the moment. I'm somehow all congested, but perhaps if I read a bit, it'll loosen up. Could be. I want to read some more passages from Mirrors by Eduardo Galeano. They're like a small collection or a large collection of moments, significant moments, and important people in the history of the struggle for human rights, I guess is a way to put it. The first known national anthem was born of a pattern unknown in England in 1745. Its verses declared the kingdom would crush the Scottish rebels to frustrate their knavish tricks. Half a century later, the Marseillais warned that the revolution would water the fields with the impure blood of the invaders. At the beginning of the 19th century, the anthem of the United States proclaimed its imperial vocation, blessed by God. Conquer we must when our cause it is just. And at the end of that century, the Germans consolidated their delayed national unity by erecting 327 statues of Emperor Wilhelm and 470 of Bismarck, while singing the anthem that put Germany über alles, over all. Generally speaking, anthems reinforce the identity of each nation by means of threats, insults, self-praise, homages to war, and the honorable duty to kill and be killed. In Latin America, these pains to the glory of the founding fathers sound like they were written for funeral pageants. The Uruguayan anthem invites us to choose between country and grave, and the Paraguayan between the republic and death. The Argentine exhorts us to vow to die with glory, and the Chilean proclaims the country's land will be the grave of the free. The Guatemalan calls for victory or death. The Cuban insists that dying for the fatherland is living. And the Ecuadorian shows that the Holocaust of Euros is a fertile seed. The Peruvian exults in the terror its cannons inspire. The Mexican recommends soaking the fatherland's standards in waves of blood. And the Colombian bathes itself in the blood of heroes who, with geographic enthusiasm, do battle at Thermopylae. Symbols of the French Revolution are female. Women of marble or bronze with powerful naked breasts, Phrygian caps, flags aflutter. But what the revolution produced was the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, when revolutionary militant Olympia de Gouges proposed a Declaration of the Rights of Women and the female citizen. She was hauled off to jail The Revolutionary Tribunal found her guilty, and the guillotine removed her head. At the foot of the scaffold, Olympia asked, "If we women have the right to face the people from the guillotine, should we not also have the right to face them from the tribune?" Not allowed. They would not speak. They could not vote. The convention, the Revolutionary Congress, closed down all women's political associations and forbade women from debating men as equals. Olympia de Gourgues' companions were sent to the lunatic asylum, and soon after her execution, it was Manon Roland's turn. Manon was the wife of the Minister of the Interior, but not even that could save her. She was found guilty of an anti-natural tendency to political activism. She had betrayed her feminine nature, which was to keep house and to give birth to brave sons, and she had committed the deadly offense of sticking her nose into the masculine affairs of men. And the guillotine dropped once more. The guillotine, a tall doorway without a door, an empty frame, and at the top, poised the deadly blade. She went by several names: the machine, the widow, the barber. When she decapitated King Louis, she became Little Louise. And in the end, one name stuck, the guillotine. Joseph Guillotine protested in vain 1,001 times. The doctor and sworn enemy of the death penalty protested that the executioner who sowed terror and drew multitudes was not his daughter. No one listened. People went right on believing that he was the father of the leading lady of the most popular show in Paris. People also believed, and still do, that Guillotine died on the guillotine. In reality, he breathed his last breath in the peace of his own bed, his head well attached to his body. But the guillotine labored on until 1977. Its last victim was a Tunisian immigrant, executed in the yard of a Paris prison by a superfast model with an electronic trigger. The revolution lost its head. To sabotage the revolution, landowners set fire to their crops. The specter of hunger roamed the cities. The kingdoms of Austria, Prussia, England, Spain, and Holland prepared for war against the contagious French Revolution, which insulted tradition and threatened the Holy Trinity of crown, wig, and cassock. Besieged from within and without, the revolution reached the boiling point. The people were the audience, watching a drama performed in their name. Not many attended the debates. There was no time. The lineups for food were long. Differences of opinion led to the scaffold. All the revolutionary leaders were enemies of monarchy, but some of them had kings in their hearts, and by a new divine revolutionary right, they were the owners of the absolute truth and absolute power. Whoever dared to disagree was a counter-revolutionary ally of the enemy, a foreign spy, a traitor to the cause. Marat escaped the guillotine because a mad girl stabbed him in the bath. Saint-Just, inspired by Robespierre, accused Danton. Danton, sentenced to death, asked them not to forget to put his head on display, and as a bequest, he left his balls to Robespierre. He said the man would need them. 3 months later, Saint-Just and Robespierre were decapitated. Without wanting it or knowing it, the desperate, chaotic republic was working for the restoration of the monarchy. The revolution, which had promised liberty, equality, and fraternity, ended up paving the way for the despotism of Napoleon Bonaparte, who founded his own dynasty. And, that's just a few sections. Maybe I'll read some more from Mirrors by Eduardo Galeano. And, perhaps if you feel like you have something to say to the world, and I do reserve the right, as I've said before, to pick and choose among the callers that seem to me to have some relevance and some that seem to me to be excessively simplistic, tedious, annoying, childish, mischievous, all those things. A little mischief, actually, is not so bad. Sometimes it's better than not so bad.
You know, I've got to report on the articles in the Panther paper.
You're on the air now, you know.
Are we on the air?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah? We are.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I just thought that I would add some information to the tape that you played from Algeria. It was Huey that hung up the phone. In the conversation between Huey and Eldridge, and I think in all fairness, since the remainder hour and a half was taken up with Eldridge Cleaver and the people in Algeria's position, that there should be some attention given to the position of the people in Oakland, Huey Newton in particular. The Black Panther Party paper came out early this morning, and the cover of the paper said, "Free Kathleen Cleaver and all other political prisoners." And the centerfold was devoted entirely to an article by Elaine Brown, who is, Deputy Minister of Information in charge of Los Angeles area. She's from Los Angeles. She has a record out called Seize the Time, and she went on the trip. 11 people, with Eldridge Cleaver also went on, that went to North Korea and North Vietnam and China in early fall. And she writes about her experiences, saying that Kathleen Cleaver has been kept a prisoner of Eldridge Cleaver for a number of months, has been mistreated, that Kathleen Cleaver was no longer in love with Eldridge, in fact was in love with one Clinton Smith, who Eldridge Cleaver killed and buried in the desert. There is a picture of Kathleen Cleaver with a black eye in the paper.
High official from the Bureau of Narcotics there, and it was a woman not saying her name, but he was, you know, says, well, we work both sides of the fence. Everybody gives them stories. We gave him a story to check out. I heard a great story, which I've never seen followed up, but one of the young delegates on the Rules Committee, who was a what they call a stand-in, you know, when the old guard is kicked out, right, and they say you got to reapportion according to age, sex, etc. So this old stag gets his daughter to sit on the Rules Committee in his seat, right, and vote the Humphrey line, you know? And all of a sudden, yeah, like, what is this stuff, you know? Like, what are you coming up with these, like, weird votes for? Have you thought this thing out? And so after a few votes, she changed her position, rebelled against her father, and he took her upstairs in the hotel and beat her up. And we tried to check that out, and I gave that to Jackie Anderson. I'm not going to mention the name of the person because I hadn't seen it, like, sort of verified, and I tried to call the hotel room, you know. But there were a lot of interesting stories. And
politicians are really crooks, aren't they? Well, at least they don't try to.
Well, they're into power. Power is politics is about power, and power is really, really messy.
There was a very good thing on Channel 13 tonight. Did you see it? Actually, did you see it or talk about it tonight? You know what happened. They had a segment on the FBI by Paul Jacobs.
I've been meaning all week to watch that.
Would you talk about that? Because I missed it.
I thought it was a tremendously interesting and important media event and something about which to study the media. And I think Channel 13 is really getting into this in some kind of good detail lately. I mean, I think there's been a change in their kind of broadcasting and their reporting. Well, anyway, it happened to do with Marshall Efren's show. I think they even refer to it now, you know, the Great American Dream Machine is the Marshall Efren show. But he's certainly a hit on that show. But they had a segment, an interview by Paul Jacobs, who's a very good radical reporter for educational TV in San Francisco. He went and interviewed three FBI informants who have stated publicly that they were told by the FBI that some of them were paid to infiltrate radical groups and act as agent provocateurs.
So this old stag gets his daughter to sit on the Rules Committee in his seat, right, and vote the Humphrey line, you know? And all of a sudden, what is this stuff, you know? Like, what are you coming up with these, like, weird votes for? Have you thought this thing out? So after a few votes, she changed.
It's unavoidable. Give him the 10, give him a lot of other things. But one thing's for damn sure, we're all here about why we're here.
Had like 40 people meeting yesterday to like each one of these people to get three or four other people to form a guerrilla team to like hit all those any people who still believe in some way that that it's going to be worked out through the American system with some fair-haired boy president someday, and also communicate to liberals about the vision and about what this revolution is really about, and also to like more important is to get the people who are already in the movement. People who only come out at demonstrations and only come out at like rock shows and come out like things in the park, but what are they doing all year long? And why do people don't want to be together? Why all over the cities, like people so spread out? People in Chicago don't go to the south, north and go to the south and go to the north, and all over in all the cities and then the campuses. The revolution is very, very superficial. You know, like people have to like feel and get away, let go of the wisecrack armor so they can feel, so they can really have a need for revolution and a desire for revolution, so the desire and need can become one. And So we're organizing people to walk over the groups of people and do anything necessary to like make people realize what this revolution is all about, like pushing their girlfriends on the floor and having these guys come over to you, attack you, say, why'd you push my girlfriend on the floor, and expose their violence as they come to attack you, or to ask them questions why they still believe in some...
All over the world, people fighting American imperialism look to America's youth to use our strategic position behind enemy lines to join forces in the destruction of the empire. Black people have been fighting almost alone for years. We've known that our job is to lead white kids into armed revolution. We never intended to spend the next 5 or 25 years of our lives in jail. Ever since SDS became revolutionary, we've been trying to show how it is possible to overcome the frustration and impotence that comes from trying to reform this system. Kids know the lines are drawn. Revolution is touching all of our lives. Tens of thousands have learned that protests and marches don't do it. Revolutionary violence is the only way. Now we are adapting the classic guerrilla strategy of the Viet Cong and the urban guerrilla strategy of the Tupamaros to our own situation here in the most technically advanced country in the world. Che taught us that revolutionaries move like fish in the sea. The alienation and contempt that young people have for this country has created the ocean for this revolution. The hundreds and thousands of young people who demonstrated in the 60s against the war and for civil rights grew to hundreds of thousands in the past few weeks, actively fighting Nixon's invasion of Cambodia and the attempted genocide against black people. The insanity of American justice...
That to get into the technicalities of this is really not exactly the point, because this is why the Congress, which collects our taxes by the billions, lectures to us about New York City and its little bitty deficit compared to the $770 billion deficit. Why should people that can just barely get to their grits, that probably don't earn, everybody in this room probably doesn't earn more than $100,000 or $200,000, and they've got all our taxes, let them find out what in the world is going on. Why is it that we have to come here and struggle around and get off planes and shuffle around and do our little stuff and then get into technicalities? I want to see those people that are responsible for this working on it. Not that we shouldn't do it too, but we are responsible, granted. Well, I don't trust them either, but the point is, let's kick them out until we get someone we do trust. Not kick out one crook and get his ally that sat on the Warren Commission and wouldn't bring Jack Ruby to Washington. I mean, Smiling Whitey Ford is a cover-up guy, and this is his payoff. And to go back to Jack Kennedy and his sex expressions, it's very important, but we got to deal with these people that are in there right now. And we have to bring pressure. I heard this, what's that fool's name? that's going to be his, they're going to throw out Bo Calloway and put him in former Secretary of the Defense Melvin Laird on talking about his quiet authority or quiet. He kept using quiet. He's quiet all right enough. He's quiet covering up his role in the Kennedy cover-up. And what I'm suggesting is that we have, among other things, and I'm perfectly prepared to go back and talk about whether or not Bobby could get it up after nine kids and whether he's, you know, insult his children and grandchildren. But to me, that is very incidental to what we are going to do to get the pigs out of this White House and to insist that the people now in office that are inheritant to this situation, who have inherited this situation, that they be held responsible and that we don't get so hung up in the emulsion and the chemistry and all. Not that this isn't crucial and important, but we're talking to people now who may or may not know about it, what caused the fuzziness on the photographs. I want the people that collect our taxes to do what needs to be done, stop covering up this stuff. I want Barbara Walters and Walter Cronkite and all these people to stop. I know you're shaking your head, and I think you're right in a sense, but that's what we must do, just like they wouldn't let them keep Lieutenant Calley in jail. We've just got to scream and holler till they do what has to be done.
Well, you
really believe
that Walter Cronkite, after lying to us for 12 years,
I don't know, but we must get him off of there. We must be sitting in, not on Bob Fass's little studio, but CBS.
I mean, do you think we could be talking in any other station around here other than this program?
Well, we ought to sit there until we can. Roll your
I think that with the proper cooperation from the people who know about it already, people who are listening now, the people who came up here tonight, and you said that you were, as the tape was played in the studio, in case you just tuned in, we played a tape in the studio tonight that we can't broadcast because the rights to it aren't cleared, of news reports on the day of the assassination. And there were people there, and they really could tell the difference between what was
the liquor store window,
prepackaged stuff that they had,
holding her dead baby weeping. Holding her baby. Drive home, my darling, drive home. Drive home so safely, drive home. Headlights smashed, the drool from the lip flares, the flashlights, the jittery cops, bladelets of grass with blood for a headdress, maniac terror of tire tracks and chalk. She was standing in the liquor store window, holding her dead baby weeping. Holding her baby. She ran up the hill with moans in her mind. She ran up the hill with moans in her mind. Oh, drive home, my darling, drive home. Shall I whisper it softly? Drive home so safely.
Hello, this is Bernadine Dorn. I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war. This is the first communication from the Weatherman Underground. All over the world, people fighting American imperialism look to America's youth to use our strategic position behind enemy lines to join forces in the destruction. Hello, this is Bernadine Dorn. I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war. This is the first communication from the Weatherman Underground. All over the world, people fighting American imperialism look to America's youth to use our strategic position behind enemy lines to join forces in the destruction of the empire. Black people have been fighting almost alone for years. We've known that our job is to lead white kids into armed revolution. We never intended to spend the next 5 or 25 years of our lives in jail. Ever since SDS became revolutionary, we've been trying to show how it is possible to overcome the frustration and impotence that comes from trying to reform this system. Kids know the lines are drawn. Revolution is touching all of our lives. Tens of thousands have learned that protests and marches don't do it. Revolutionary violence is the only way. Now we are adapting the
symbol addicted
strategy of the Viet Cong and the urban guerrilla strategy of the Putumayos.
Is made uneasy by the thought of people turning inward. Drugs, the terror word of the 20th century. But let's face this issue of drugs bluntly and factually. The embarrassing truth is that consciousness is a chemical phenomenon. Everything that you have ever experienced, you experienced because of a chemical reaction in your nervous system. Memory is a chemical process. Learning is a chemical process. Stupidity is a chemical process. Stupor is a chemical process. Normal awareness is a chemical process. Language of your body is the language of molecules. The retina of your eye, the delicate membrane of your ear, your nerve cells, your tissue cells do not speak English, nor Latin, nor French. They're designed, they have been designed, by a 2 billion year process of trial and error to receive, decode, and send out a language which is chemical. Perhaps the mystery and the fear itself, which surrounds the word drugs, is due to the fact that he who deals with symbols deals with changing and structures. But he who deals with chemicals tampers with the basic power and energy of life.
The purpose of PIL is to concretize the facts about Timothy Leary and to dispel the rumor, speculation, and government propaganda that has been afloat for the past couple of months. We are simply fed up with being victimized by the government's conspiracy mongering and its attempts to shatter the cohesiveness of the left. Not everyone on this panel is a member of PIL. In fact, only Jerry Rubin and myself of the people speaking here today are. But all of us here are united in our condemnation of the actions of the government in forcibly extracting confessions from political prisoners in the jails of this country. And all of us here are united in our concern for Timothy Leary's present situation. By setting up Timothy Leary as a government agent, the Justice Department is using the same old divide-and-conquer, red-baiting ploys it has used in the Palmer raids, the McCarthy hearings, the Rosenberg case, and the Watergate plumbers. It's important to remember that the Justice Department, under the likes of John Mitchell, Richard Kleindienst, and Robert Mardian, tried all their dirty tricks first out on the left before they moved on to the Democratic Party. In fact, one of the few remaining slimesters from the Watergate fallout is Guy Goodwin, who conducted a series of federal witch hunt grand juries for the past 4 years. In Gainesville with the Vietnam veterans, in Harrisburg with the Harrisburg 8 war resistors, in dozens of other cities around the country, Guy Goodwin's modus operandi has been the same. Intimidation, coercion, and the threat of an unlimited jail sentence for failure to cooperate with his dragnet. In most cases, those subpoenaed to his grand juries have resisted his tactics, some people serving months in jail in order to preserve their constitutional and human rights. And in Gainesville with William Wimmer, in Harrisburg with Boyd Douglas, the witnesses Goodwin did manage to snooker were exposed as self-admitted perjurers and liars. There is no reason to assume that Timothy Leary has been spared Guy Goodwin's vice grip. Unlike so many other courageous victims of Goodwin's fishing expeditions, however, Leary has decided to lie his way out of jail. We can only hope that Leary's credibility will be taken on a par with Goodwin's past witnesses. For years, the government has been convinced that leftist lawyers are the satraps who report directly to Mao Zedong, then dispense Mao's orders to the rest of the left. Having been before one of Goodwin's inquisitions 3 years ago myself, I can attest to the fact that he was as interested in the attorneys representing us as he was in the people he actually subpoenaed. Now, with Timothy Leary's cooperation, the government's biggest fish to date, the Justice Department feels it is in a position to finally go after leftist lawyers, using his testimony as a cornerstone. Obviously, the fantasies of an affidavit nymphomaniac like Leary are easily impeached in a court of law, so the government will rely on the grand jury to find any corroborating lies that it can. No one who has had any contact with Leary over the years should be surprised if an FBI agent comes knocking at the front door early some morning with a subpoena to spill his or her guts before one of Guy Goodwin's grand juries. Being in front of a grand jury is akin to being in the court of the Queen of Hearts. No right of attorney, no right to the Fifth Amendment, only the imperious chopping block mentality of Guy Goodwin, the Red Queen. Anyone who is subpoenaed should immediately contact the National Lawyers Guild, an organization that has developed much expertise and which has compiled an excellent track record in dealing with Goodwin's perfidy. Nor should anyone be surprised if sweeping indictments come down, charging a score of leftist attorneys from coast to coast with everything from aiding and Leary's escape from prison to running nuclear submarines into Albania. The statement Jerry Rubin will read shortly is the fruit of a carefully researched investigation drawing upon many sources. There are, by the way, a couple of extra points Jerry will make which are not on the fact sheet which we've distributed to the press. Many of these sources are in the Justice Department itself and for obvious reasons must remain anonymous. Other sources must likewise be unnamed for their fear of government retaliation. The first speaker will be Jerry Rubin, former Chicago 7 defendant.
You should have done even more. So I'm better than that. No, I'm just going to also over that chair.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm going to
be down a little bit more. Maybe somebody should move a chair down here. This is a press conference that I wish was not taking place.
It is a symptom of the credibility crisis in America, symbolized by Watergate and President Ford's pardoning of Richard Nixon. There's a straight line between Watergate and Timothy Leary. The people who are today directing Leary's testimony before a federal grand jury in Chicago are the same people who are working under John Mitchell and Robert Mardian in the Justice Department before Mitchell and Mardian were forced to quit and were indicted. Although the chiefs have been caught and indicted, the people working under them in the Justice Department have not stopped their illegal prosecution activities of fear, intimidation, illegal surveillance, and enemy lists. At the exact time that President Ford has made a mockery of our judicial system by putting the former President of the United States above the law, the very same Justice Department has both forced and persuaded Timothy Leary to lie and fabricate elaborate stories to get out of jail. The purpose of this press conference is to act before it is too late. If we remain silent, we are in complicity with the government in its illegal acts. Watergate is not over. Watergate continues today in the case of Timothy Leary. A federal grand jury meeting in Chicago is considering indictments right now based on the testimony of Leary. Indictments, as we found out in the case of Nixon, are political decisions made by human beings in reaction to public opinion. A major purpose of the Chicago grand jury is to shift public attention from the crimes of Nixon, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Mitchell to fabricated enemies on the left. If we speak out now, we can influence our government to put its priorities on human problems and human suffering and not on ghosts from the past. My role in this press conference is to present the facts as we know them and place them in some context. This is not a typical press conference. Statements will be educational and be as long as necessary to cover the details. It's not a pleasant or happy task for me to be in front of cameras again. I've been inactive politically for 3 to 4 years, and I'm doing this press conference for one reason, because I have information that close personal friends of mine are in direct danger of having their lives disrupted and endangered by the testimony, by the government's attempt to use the testimony of Leary to take our attention off Watergate and related matters. The context of what's going on must be placed within an understanding of the American prison system.
Did any of those excerpts from the last 40 years strike any chords in either of you two? Robbie, Bill?
I've heard them before. Some familiar voices. I'm trying to think if they resonated. Is that, that's what you're asking, I think.
Yeah.
How could it not?
Yeah, how could it not?
I mean, this is the, you know, it's like that commercial, the fabric of our lives.
Do you feel any similarities between those times and these?
Rather similar.
Well,
I don't view it that way. We're smarter.
One thing that that era contained and this era and the next era will contain, and that's WBAI in New York City, which this is. This is WBAI in New York City, and KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, and roughly half an hour, we'll be visited by the good people at WSLR in Grahamsville, Liberty, and Points North.
WSLR? Is that a new station that's joined us?
Oh, JFF.
Where is WSLR?
SLR. No, that's another station. That's single lens reflex. Right. No, WJFF in Grahamsville, Liberty, and Lake Minisink, New York. I expect we'll be getting a call soon from someone who's trying to preserve the water that we drink from chemical emulsions. Both sides in gas dispute rally in Albany. Fracking's foes and proponents equally adamant. Well, let's trust the newspaper to not choose sides. This is pretty messed up facts. I can't really read one of the... I can read Chief... It will destroy the water and destroy the land, no question about it. That's Chief Aaron Lyons of the Onondaga Nation. It's proven and safe. That's Assemblyman William, can't read his name, from North Harmony, pointing to scores of wells in his western New York district. On golf courses, school grounds, and even in Jamestown's aquifers. Well, it's clear to most of the people who've really examined it that when the chemical slurry that they make of the good clean water they pump out of, say, the Delaware River or the Hudson in their dreams, or even wells, or they carry the water in by tanker trucks from some other place when the water is mixed with chemicals and turned into high-pressured steam that's pumped down to the Moss Salis Shale. The water that they use has got to go somewhere. The gas that is extracted is pumped to light the lanterns and the electric power supplies and homes they trust in New York State and in other parts of the world and nation. But when that water goes back into the ground, it leaks. Water is a solvent. And when it's charged with the kind of chemicals that are added to it, it becomes a super solvent. And it leaks into the aquifer, into the underground streams that... purify the water and drop it into the reservoirs and the pipes that feed New York City. And anyone who looks at the places where this kind of thing has happened in Pennsylvania and in some of our less enlightened Western states. Yeehaw! Something terrible happens to the water that people drink and bathe with. So, it's a pretty foregone conclusion, but you have to have money invested in an oil company not to see it. You want to discuss this subject, we'll probably be doing that sometime during the night. We're at WBAI in New York City, and the number to call is 209-2900. We might also get a report or two on the concert for Thule Kupferberg that was held in Brooklyn last week. I heard that it was quite wonderful. and that there was one startling act where a bevy of tall, beautiful women clothed in air sang Slum Goddess. It was a great moment. I think they're called, the group is called Karen Finley's Turgid Nightmare. No, could that be it? I don't remember the name. Perhaps someone will call and tell us. You might be on the air. You might be on the air. Hee-haw. And you're on the air.
Morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Yeah, I wondered if you might want to talk about the passing of Howard Zinn. I don't know if you ever had him on your show. Seems like
no, I didn't, but I've listened to tapes of his public statements very often.
You ever read
and
any
I've read,
books?
I read Howard Zinn's history. I think it's first. The first is called A History for Young People. Wasn't there a book?
Yeah, and the
and then his classic work is Howard Zinn's History of the United States.
Yeah, the People's History.
People's History, right, yeah. right.
Yeah, you know, I've been hearing all just gushing praise for this guy, and I think he was a quite an excellent scholar and puts and sort of a balance to sort of kind of hero worshipy histories that you and I got when we were in elementary school about Columbus sailing the ocean blue in 1492 or whatever it was. But I gotta say, I think his books are very simplistic. I think that he takes a lot, I mean a lot, of the complexity out of American history. If you take and I know people will say, well,
he's
only showing the left wing side, and if you want the right wing side, then read another book. But if you put a right wing book and a left wing book, I mean, if you put a right wing book and Howard Zinn's history together, you still don't have the whole story.
Well, first, you never have the whole story of history. You only have narratives of in certain incidents that the historian thinks are important. Those things that I read by Galeano aren't everything that happened in those particular years.
Okay, but let me give you an example.
But there are moments. But let me finish because you said a bunch of things. I got a fortune cookie that said true wisdom is making the complicated appear simple. So it's true, they are they're simple statements about what happened, but they're a part of the history that I wasn't taught in public school. I had to wait until I got a little, I got old enough to walk to the second candy store on the other side of Nostrand Avenue, where I could get the compass and PM and, radical newspapers, The Nation. You know, these things were like the other side of history. And in The Nation, there was a cartoon called Through History with J. Wesley Smith that kind of opened my eyes in a lot of ways. It was the other side. But when you read about Howard Zinn, you read about things like the Whiskey Rebellion.
Yes.
Which, kind of get glossed over. You know, what were the economic underpinnings of the Whiskey Rebellion? Serious, important stuff. You know,
it is, and I appreciate his contribution, but you know, the
who is your historian of?
Well, I can compare just to throw this out there. I could compare for books that really have a complex view of history. I could compare his book, which is a history book, with another book which doesn't even pretend to be a history book, but actually has much more history in it, which is Lies My Teacher Told Me, which has a very, very complex view of American history. But let me just, and it's, everyone should read that book that's interested in the book.
I've heard of that. Who's the author of that?
You know, I can't even remember off the top of my head.
Well, see, that's what history is like. There are significant details, important personages that kind of slip away. For some reason, you can't remember the name of the author of that book, and people can't remember the fact that the pilgrims would have starved had it not been for the beneficence of the Native Americans who let them share their food and who were invited to a dinner and then murdered.
Right. No.
Yeah.
That's not where did you get that? That's not Thanksgiving. They didn't invite them to dinner and kill all the Indians.
Not all of them, just the ones that showed up.
That's not what happened, though.
It is.
Someone lies. No. Well, anyway.
Was you there?
The people's history purports to be a history of the oppressed, right? So, but when you, and he talks, for instance, about the first slave ship that came in, 1609 or whatever it was. But the what he doesn't even mention that I find just outrageous is that white people were slaves too.
They were slaves of a different sort.
It was somewhat of a different sort.
Well, if you're interested in the history of that, I don't know the actual minute details, but there was a time when black people and white people it was possible for them to buy their freedom after a certain number of years of indenture, a certain number of years of work, and they were no longer indentured. But the laws changed to make a distinction between the black slave and the white slave. White man's slavery became more likely to be wage slavery.
Yeah, but this portrayal of
But he still wasn't allowed to vote, and neither was the black man, of course, because he didn't own property.
You know, I'm of European descent, but I have an ancestor that was brought to this continent in chains. He was on the royalist side during the English Civil War.
Well, I have ancestors who were thrown out of this country in chains. How do you like that?
Okay, but what I'm saying is that some voluntarily entered indenturement, but many were brought here as slaves because they belonged to a religion.
Or because they were prisoners and they were offered the option of slavery in the colony or, incarceration in places like the Newgate prison where if you didn't have somebody bringing you food or money to buy food from the jailers, you starved.
Well, the British term is transport.
That's right.
People are certainly familiar with, the penal colony in Australia, but that was only.
Can you say that on the radio?
Huh?
Can you say that on the radio?
Well, but that was founded after the opportunity to send convicts to the American colonies dried up because of the American Revolution. The state of the colony of Georgia was founded as a penal colony.
Well, wait, you know, what didn't completely dry up because the British Navy went on kidnapping American sailors and saying, you're a British sailor now.
Yes, well, but they also did that to their own citizens.
Does that make it right?
No, obviously it's wrong, Bob.
Does it make it less slavery? Look, let me tell you about an insight that I had today. All peoples, at one time or another, have been the unpaid vassals and servants of imperial peoples, all peoples. It's not anything new, but what was done to black slaves was, it's almost like it was mechanized. It was made into an industry, and previously it was not so developed because that many slaves weren't required. I mean, maybe the Mayans required that many slaves. Maybe the Egyptians or other monument-building peoples, road-building peoples required lots and lots of slaves. Maybe, maybe we should all go and look at Spartacus. But what happened to black people was of a magnitude completely different. What happened to Jewish people who were forced to work in Nazi munitions factories was completely different. The concentration camp, which was developed by Cecil Rhodes in his prime years, was based on the reservations that American Indians were put into. The concentration camps of Nazi Germany were like the higher form of that. It's very hard to draw a distinction between different kinds of suffering, you know, different kinds of oppression.
Bob, the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me is James W. Lowen.
Mm-hmm.
L-O-E-W-E-N.
Lowen?
James W. Lowen.
Mm-hmm.
A really good book about that deals with this, among other things, is the question of white slavery is Jim Goad's book. His last name is G-O-A-D. It's called The Redneck Manifesto. But the fact is, hundreds of thousands of British, Scots, and Irish were brought to North America and the Caribbean as slaves. They were slaves all their lives in many cases. In many cases, they were never allowed to work off their indenture because they were dead before they ever...
That's why they invented zombies.
Well, the thing is, I mean, but that was also a very heroic part of American history because those whites who worked, white slaves worked side by side with black slaves. They worked together. They slept together. They ate together. They loved each other. They learned from each other. That's why when you go down to the Caribbean island like Barbados, you notice the black folks there speak with the Irish accent. That's not a fluke. It's because there were thousands of Irish slaves working side by side with the black slaves. And what bothers me again with Howard Zinn is he completely leaves it out. I mean, he doesn't even mention that there were white slaves, and it was an important part of American history. And the fact was, It's too late
for him to correct that, but you could write your own history and include that.
Well, people often say the black slaves were treated worse. Actually, the white slaves were treated worse because they were considered to be less valuable. The white slaves were essentially free because they were imprisoned because of like you said, either they were either convicts or they were political or religious dissidents. But the black slaves had to be obtained from Africa at great expense, so they were valuable. The white slaves were just worked to death. They were considered worthless. And it's an important part of our history, and I think we should study it. And Howard Zinn just completely left it out.
Give the guy a break. He's dead.
He was I'm not putting him down. He was a great guy, but he over just what this book Lies My Teacher Told Me talks about is how history is oversimplified. One of the motivations is teachers often believe that people children can't understand history if it's nuanced, if it's complicated. So they simply they oversimplify things to the point where they become lies. And that's what Howard Zinn was. He just left out one of the most important facets of American history. Well. And the fact is, as a person of Scots-Irish descent, I feel great solidarity and love for black people. I feel connected to them. It's not like my ancestors were slaves, and I say, well, big deal, my ancestors were slaves too. No, I just the opposite. I say I empathize with you because my ancestors were slaves also. Let's work together to make this a better world rather than this thing we often get where black people say, we're the only ones that have ever suffered in the history of the world. And and everyone has to kowtow to us and do what we say. I don't think that's a legitimate form of political organizing, and I don't think it's a legitimate way of looking at history.
Well, I can't disagree with you, but I just want to point out that when you're in the dentist chair and you haven't been given enough Novocaine, it's hard to think about other people's suffering.
I understand.
When you're suffering, your suffering is the whole world.
That's why we got to empathize with each other and help each other.
Well, it's a struggle. It's a struggle, and don't be too disappointed when people don't find it easy.
No, I don't expect it to be easy, but I'm not gonna quit loving my black brothers and sisters. I don't care what they do. I'm gonna still love them. I'm still gonna care about them. I'm still gonna try to help them. And we could get along better if they understand that my ancestors were also slaves. That we have this thing in common. That I can empathize with them, and maybe they can empathize with me.
Do you still suffer from post-slavery syndrome?
Yes.
In what
yes,
way?
I come from a traumatized people. They're called the rednecks, the hillbillies. White trash. Their culture was destroyed by the experience of slavery. I guess we're in recovery, just like the black folks are in recovery. But it's harder because it's hard to cure disease unless you know what you're sick from, and black people know they're sick from slavery and Jim Crow, but white people they don't even know what happened to them. They know something went wrong, but they don't know. They don't know what happened to them.
Traumatized son of a slave?
My name's Larry.
Larry, I'm glad you called, Larry.
Bob, if I say I love you, don't be embarrassed. But I do. Hey, God bless you.
Oh, I'm so embarrassed. Thank you, Larry. Thank you. Bye. You're on the radio. Hello?
Yeah, for Larry's benefit, I'm sitting in front of a copy of Lies, my teacher told me.
Uh-huh.
And on the inside cover, there's a quote from Zinn which says, every teacher, every student of history, every citizen should read this book. It is both a refreshing antidote to what has passed for history in our educational system and a one-volume education in itself. You know, it's sometimes hard to let the dead rest.
Well, sure, we want them to get up and do more of their good work.
Yeah, well,
right.
You know, but it's, there's also, if Larry's interested, two revisionist historians, Redeker and Peter Linnabaugh, who've written a book that discusses what Larry talks about. So that's all I had to say.
Thank you. What's your name?
All right, Sam.
Sam, thank you.
All right. Bye, Bob.
Bye.
Talk about revisionist historians. Howenson wasn't even called today when coming here. I turned over to NPR and heard David Horowitz, the self-appointed historian to set the record straight, talking about Zinn in less than glowing terms. Remember him, David Horowitz? It's not worth mentioning the name, but I'm sorry to give it currency here.
You're on the radio. Hello. Good morning. Hi, Carl.
Hey, people are really, and they want a satiric version of the history of the United States. They should get on CD or look for the original Stan Freberg Discovers the United States of America, which I believe is the title. It's hysterical.
We're waiting for the electrician or someone like him.
Yeah, well, I'm not into the parasite theory, but Stan Freberg Discovers the United States of America. It's hysterical. I mean, how can anybody not love a song like Take an Indian to Lunch This Week, showing that we're a regular bunch this weekend? It's just,
well, maybe if you sing it, they won't love it.
I don't know all the words, unfortunately.
Well,
I am a singer, yes.
You're no Moogie Klingman.
Huh?
You're no Moogie Klingman.
Oh, I think I sing better than Moogie. That's an insult, Bob. I definitely think I have a better voice than Boogie Cleveland. That's not really what I called to talk about.
Don't be embarrassed, Carl, but I love you.
Thank you. I have an update on Ray's. And yes, I think I seem better than Boogie Cleveland, but anyway. We had a demonstration on Saturday in the cold. 50 people, loud, boisterous. And Ray made more money that night than I think he's made in a very, very long time. He paid off his December rent, which about $3,500 a month. He still needs to pay January. He still needs to pay his January rent. But there's going to be a fundraiser for him on Saturday at Sidewalk. Not this Saturday, but February
6th. You want to say who Ray is and talk about his store?
Sure. Ray owns a candy store on Avenue 8 between St. Mark's Place and 7th Street. St. Mark's Place is essentially 8th Street. And Ray's been there since 1974. He's a neighborhood institution, a friend of all of us, living squatters, punks, working people, even the cops, unfortunately. And the cops went in there Saturday and bought stuff from him. There were people giving him money and not demanding their change back. And the article in the Villager said that Matt Metzger, who was a squatter in the neighborhood, bought a $20 cup of coffee. Just gave him a $20 bill. You know, that's what we think of Ray. You know, Ray's a very, very unique, very special guy. And you can go to Ray's and hang out on a cold winter night or in the summer and hear people exchanging gossip, news about the neighborhood, arguing and talking politics. It's a neighborhood hangout. And the Lower East Side would be nothing without Ray's, literally. And without Ray's and Odessa, because Odessa is a neighborhood, greasy spoon, where a lot of Lower East Side people hang out and eat and talk politics and exchange gossip and news also. So, you know, we would be nothing, especially without Ray's.
All I'd heard, you know, I mean, up until the time we decided to do the concert, there'd been very little that I'd actually read about it. I'd read little pieces here and there. I'd heard a little bit on television in England. No, it's the same. I mean, it just happens to be East Pakistan now, as far as I can see. It happens to be that which we're doing the benefit for. It's particularly a bad situation. But, I mean, it does happen all the time. You know, this is happening everywhere, like Biafra was last year.
Mr. Harrison, with all of the enormous problems in the world, how did you happen to choose this one to do something about?
Because I was asked by a friend if I'd help, you know, that's all.
This is WBAI in New York City, and we're being joined now by WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, New York.
Suggestions. Once I decided I was going to go onto the show, then I organized the things with a little help from my friends. Now, all these musicians came. Some of them flew thousands of miles, didn't get paid for anything. Dylan, you know, he was really into the whole idea of it for the refugees. So the concert made $250,000, which actually is really very small in terms of the amount of money from the record. That way we can feed the starving people. And that's it, it just snowballed.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I'd just like to say before we start off with the concert that to thank you all for coming here. And as you all know, it's a special benefit concert. We've got a good show lined up, I hope so anyway. First part of the concert is going to be an Indian music section. You're going to hear a sitar and sarod duet. And as you realize, the Indian music's a little bit more serious than our music, and I appreciate if you could try and settle down and get into the Indian music section. So let me introduce on sitar Ravi Shankar. And the master of sarod, Ustad Ali Akbar Khan, sarod. I'm sure you all know Ravi's tabla player, Alaraka. And this evening the drone instrument, the tambura, is being played by Kamala. So I hope you enjoy the concert. Thank you.
Friends, as George told you just now, they will be participating in the second part. The first part is going to be us playing for you on the Indian instruments, the Indian music. This is a type of music which needs a little concentrated listening. And I would request you to have little patience. I know you are very impatient to hear your favorite stars who would be in the second part. But we are trying to set the music to this special event, this historical program which is just not a program as usual, but which has a message. And this is to just make you aware of a very serious situation that is happening. We are not trying to make any politics. We are artists. But through our music, we would like you to feel the agony and also the pain and lot of sad happenings in Bangladesh and also the refugees who have come to India. We will play a dhun, which means an air or a melody, which is based on a folk tune of Bangladesh. And after that, we'll play a gath, a fast gath in teen tal of 16 beats. Now, as usual, I would request you, my friends, to refrain or stop from smoking while the program is on. Thank you very much. Thank you. If you appreciate the tuning so much, I hope you'll enjoy the playing more.
Thank you.
Listening to the concert for Bangladesh. This is WBAI in New York City, KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, and WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, New York. And Did I mention that we're streaming on the World Wide Web at WBAI.org? Yes, we are!
You don't need loving. You don't need no bed plan. You don't need no horoscope or a bag. You don't see them at your end. You open up your heart.
I believe you're on the air.
I thought I heard someone say WJFF.
Yes, I think it was me.
Good morning, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Have you heard? I have heard, and not only that. I want to, you know me with my tricks here. Let me give you 8 seconds. I think of this.
As a matter of fact, which reminds me. I want to take a few of you guys back with me in the boat to prove I discovered you.
What do you mean, discover us? We discover you.
You discovered us?
Certainly. We discover you on beach here. It's all how you look at it.
That sounds like Stan Freberg.
That was Stan. That was, it was in the middle of the stack, and I pulled it out successfully without knocking the stack over. But I want to mention if you really want to hear, I mean, I don't know, Howard Zinn, I think, is going to be one of those people that even though he's gone, at least he was on his way to on a project on a bus, and it was over like that, and that's all you can hope for. But if you want to hear a really good interview, you can go back to the archives. Your friend Robert Knight really played a really good interview with a journalist that I don't know. I didn't recognize her. And he was really good. It's the best interview I've ever heard him do. And he's one of those guys that he's always going to be around. But anyway.
Robert Knight.
Well, Howard Zinn and hopefully Robert Knight also.
Okay.
And, but just that... just that one part about discovering them and wanting to take some Indians back. When you hear that interview, I don't want to get gruesome, but if you hear what Columbus did to the natives, forcing them to look for gold that wasn't there, and then doing what he did to them. I'm not even going to mention it. Listen to the archive. But thanks for. I heard that you read part of the newspaper coverage of the gas dispute rally.
Well, Fred, the facts that I was reading from was pretty smudged, but I read a couple of lines that seemed to capture both the position of the people who don't want to drink that stuff and the people who say, hey, it's health food.
Well, it seems like things... Oh, God, health food. It seems like things are turning a bit. A good indication of that is Senator Bonasek, New York State Senator, only a week ago, maybe it's 2 weeks ago, was defending the rights of the landowners. It says the DEP should not attempt to take away private rights in the Catskills without additional compensation for those rights and this and that. It's about people enriching themselves from gas extraction at the risk to everyone else. And in today's paper, he totally turned around, and his closing comment, it should not be driven by anticipated revenues from the energy companies. We have to be slow. We have to be deliberate, and balance these things and this and that. But he mentions harm to the environment. So he seems to somebody woke him up. He must have gotten some material and realized that this stuff is just criminal.
He had somebody take a poll or something and say the people think this is criminal. All right, okay. Criminal it is.
Well, hopefully that's it, because anyone that, with a little bit of sunlight on this subject with elected representatives, I don't see how they could possibly be reelected if they try and facilitate this. I just want to know, I don't know how many people are following this. It's, not that many people comment on it on the show. There have been a few people. But the turnout in Albany was at least two to one. I was hoping for 10 to 1 anti-drillers against drillers, but at least it was 2 to 1. There were about 750, 800 people, and they said it was at least 500 to 250, so that's not too bad. But I think your premium department is going to have DVDs available by the Endocrine Disruption folks out from Colorado.
Yeah, I spoke to Tony Bates today, and he said that was going to happen.
And I just got a package of some of the some DVDs, so some of them at least will come in the factory jackets. And there's nothing really special, but at least it's a nice shiny cover, and we all like that. But enclosed with the package that I received today was one DVD. On the title of it is The Male Predicament, and there's a really good statement inside that I'll read. That's really important. And if folks, anyone's online and they want to multitask, if they could go to the act that before Congress that Theo Colburn had a lot to do with, it's the Endocrine Disruption Prevention Act, introduced by John Kerry. But the quote in this endocrine disruption DVD, which I was trying to listen to while I was listening to your show, it's hard to do three or four things at once. There is now sufficient evidence to support the hypothesis that male and female reproductive problems, autism, learning and attention disorders, diabetes, obesity, immune disorders, cancer, asthma, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and more could be part of the result of prenatal exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals. Key line, the first line, there is now sufficient evidence. So that's really
Yeah, Fred, come on, it's endocrine.
Did I say that?
No. What are you, one of these nuclear guys? We're going to put you on the Donald Duck and send you across the Delaware River.
Is this Robbie?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Robbie. How are you?
And people who don't know what the Donald Duck is don't know that Stan Freberg history. That was the boat that George Washington crosses the Delaware River on. But okay, anyway, it's endocrine.
I thought I said endocrine.
No, you were saying something. I'm trying to figure out, like, what is he talking about? Is this a part of geology that I'm not aware? Is this a place that I don't know that has got endangered species or something? The
endangered species.
Yeah, the Endocrine Protection Act. Well, now I get it. I'd like to have my endocrines protected, but as I get older, they just seem to be fading away. But the important ones, anyway.
I wanted to mention again, Josh Fox, the filmmaker, has a film, Gasland, entered in the Sundance competition. And
Charlie Chaplin has one called Gaslight. That already won, probably.
Well, I hope so. Amy Goodman had clips of a film on that sounded really, really good also early in the week, and I'm a little afraid. But
I heard Robert Redford on there.
But one quick take from this article. The film was not complete when we went... I can't read tonight. The film was not complete when we sent it to Sundance, but they accepted it without it being finished. I think they realize it's a very important issue, and it is. So that... That was nice of Sundance to take it prematurely.
Sort of like Schubert's Symphony No. 8.
Exactly. Exactly.
Important, but unfinished.
The Unbegun Symphony?
The Unbegun, yeah. I have a lot of those. Another good article is there was a meeting of... Patrick Hooker, the agricultural commissioner of New York State, with a group of farmers, and the farmers are organized. And it says the organization also addressed the.
Is this the old joke about the farmers and the hooker? Come on.
There is a joke in there somewhere. But as far as the chemicals, they're planning to join a lawsuit if any of these chemicals are used. So I think we're making progress. There are a lot of things happening. And
what are the areas in Pennsylvania where this fracking has already ruined the water supply?
Well, that's in this issue also. I'd refer folks to riverreporter.com, January 28th issue. There's an investigation going on right now as far as polluted wells. They've closed some of them down, and what they did is I didn't highlight everything here, but they sent a plane up and looked at a site, the site surrounding one of those containment pools of chemicals. The trees in the area looked healthy, but they had lost all their leaves. So I don't know what that means. How can a tree look healthy in the summertime if it lost all its leaves? So they're doing further investigation. And
there are a lot of confused Battlestar Galactica people who are wondering, how is it possible that fracking can pollute water?
It's just amazing. I don't have the list of chemicals before me, but it's we're up to 350 chemicals. The last list I sent down was 280, but containing unpronounceable chemicals.
No, I understand that, but they were using that verb form
in a
completely different context. So it needs to be explained to people who have only heard it, and probably the much bigger audience who have heard that as an act between two people that involves small amounts of fluid.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, these folks are really speaking out at these demonstrations. I mean, they want a total ban in New York State, statewide ban, and then stop the fracking lies, and some innovative lettering on some of the signs. I just wanted to, you know, this is going on all over. I got a call while John McDonough's program was in progress, and it seems that the same thing is happening off the shore of Ireland. I think that those countries there, in the European community, I don't think they allow this type of drilling with chemicals, horizontal hydrofracturing with chemicals, allowed on their property. That's why Norway bought 40% of a company's leases here. And also Total of France has bought leases here. But apparently, directly offshore of Ireland, they're killing all the fish and everything. I didn't hear the program, and I haven't been able to get to someone's archives to hear the whole thing. If John happens to be listening, he may want to say something about it. But this is going on all over, but it's not going to happen here.
Is this outside of Ireland's jurisdiction? Is it international waters that they're using?
No, I think it's close enough to shore. It's a from what I've been able to get from folks that have called me are the facts that there are two small communities, one community of 800 people and another one nearby. I'm not sure, but apparently it's right off the shore because there are dead fish washing up on the shore and they wouldn't be able to put it together if it was far out to sea. So apparently it's close. But I really think we're going to stop it here. I really do. I just wish that the ratio would have been 10 to 1 in Albany. It would have said a lot, but it was a terrible day for traveling. It was at 50-mile-an-hour winds and heavy rain, so...
So are there going to be further hearings, or?
Well, everyone is asking for at least a delay on the
licensing,
on the digestion and the relettering of all the facts that have come in. And thanks to New York Radio and your show, probably in particular, Bob, they'd never expected 12,500 and some odd responses. Both written and verbal, and I was at a meeting to where the DEC representative said that we were overwhelmed. It's going to take much longer for us to go through because they do have to address all the comments.
I heard that out of that many thousand, I think they chose 100 as being substantive. That's what I heard on the WBAI news.
Really?
Yeah, 100 out of like 30,000.
Well. More calls to the governor. It'll take a minute, but I'll get the...
Maybe they also need truth squads following some of the politicians around. For instance, in this article that I'm trying to squint to see, there's a politician there, Assemblyman William... looks like Parment. Anyway, he's from North Harmony, a Democrat, pointing to scores of wells in his western New York district. On golf courses, school grounds, even in Jamestown's aquifers. It's proven then safe, he said to a crowd of landowners. I mean, extremists is what State Senator Tom Libouce, a Republican from Binghamton, called opponents. It's proven then safe, extremists. Like, you know, where, you know, all you need is a couple of people who were informed to follow them around and hound them.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Well, anything works. A year ago, I think I asked someone on Bob's program, an activist from the 50s, about, you know, what, you know, advice or suggestions on what to do, and he said everything. You do everything. And he's absolutely right. But the number for the governor and the DEC and the attorney general just happened to surface out of a pile of, and I'll give a minute for people to grab a pen or pencil. The DEC and the Attorney General would probably be the better ones to call at this point because the governor, I don't know, I can't imagine. The DEC...
He's not reading his messages.
What's that?
He's not reading his messages.
He's not reading his messages. No, he's a brilliant guy, but they got to him like they get to everybody. Who has more money than the Petroplex? The DEC is 845-256-3000. 845-256-3000. And Andy Cuomo is 518-474-5481. 518-474-5481. And cumulatively, maybe all these phone calls and comments will at least get a moratorium for a couple of years, and then we can work on a total ban. It's perfectly safe done on another planet.
I didn't realize that prehistoric birds had bank accounts.
You know, another thing is they've discovered some, you know, fossils, and the value of the Marcellus Shale is, you know, to geologists and archaeologists is really worth discovering. There's a lot of history there.
Yeah, you can dig up some petroplexes.
There you go. Now, you know, there's an organization called the Beehive Collective. It's a group of artists that put all these situations into art form on large murals on silk, I think it is. Just wonderful, great group. But this young fellow Tyler, really impressive, explained. He was more focused on coal. He's just coming up to speed on the gas in the Marcellus Shale. But as far as coal goes, he explained that years ago, this shale deposit is 400 million years old. 400 million years ago, the planet was pretty much covered with water, much more, about 7/8 of, covered with water. But there was a lot of swamps with giant ferns that were like little ferns that are knee-high, were as large trees. And that's what cleansed all the toxic chemicals out of the atmosphere. And then they were layered over, and they ended up 8,000 feet down, and that's where they should stay, because they're highly toxic, even without the additional chemicals. That's why they're down there. Pretty simple, actually. Robbie, can I ask you a question about
sure.
your radio history? An English fellow that does a program on JFF, the Brit Mix. I thought I heard you mention that when you went to England, you did worked with Pirate Radio and then Capital One or something like that?
I never worked with Pirate Radio. I worked with the first commercial radio station in...
What year was that?
1973.
73, that's about what we thought.
It began operation on October 15th, 1973, as the first commercial radio station in the UK, Capital Radio. Now it, of course, is a conglomerate of about 26 different radio stations and digital outlets and so on. But at that time, it was just one radio station.
Yeah, I remember you saying that there was a lot of live music because they didn't want pre-recorded music on
Well, they wanted pre-recorded music on because it's the big money maker, but they were limited by the unions. Bob, I think, mentioned a couple of weeks ago this concept called needle time, where the unions had basically negotiated an arrangement where there were only so many hours, literally clocked, that recordings could be played throughout a 24-hour day. And obviously those were concentrated during the important listening hours on a radio station when the audience would be maximized and the advertising revenue, since it was the first commercial station, would be maximized, leaving all of the other hours to fend for themselves with various things. But one of the other things that the union was kind enough to create was a requirement that a certain proportion of the radio station's income be spent on live musicians, because of the fear at the outset that somehow playing records all the time or even part of the time would put live music out of business. Of course, that never happened and never would happen. But it even reached the point where Capitol Radio was making so much money that they actually had their own full symphony orchestra, you know, with 120 players doing, you know, 1 hour classical music program on a Sunday afternoon, just so that they could pay 120 musicians the going rate to just get rid of the money out of their bottom line in order to, you know, satisfy that percentage requirement. That's all gone, of course. It's been 35 years since that happened.
Bob plays all his pays all his musicians very well, from what I hear.
Yeah.
I think so.
That's right. They, you know, anybody who's been on Radio Unnameable in the past 45 years has truly benefited from the fact that Bob has given them a microphone.
That's for sure. I'll second that.
And it also applies to people like me and Bill, who have benefited from the fact that we have been given a microphone, even though sometimes we don't really have a lot of constructive things to say. But we like to listen to our own voice. Don't we?
The name of the second piano composition by Mr. Lamotte is Mundo. It was played in his house in Bellevue, Port-au-Prince, December 20th, 1936.
then what? I get out, out the door. That's a girl, how you do? Seems so proud of having to be.
Thank you. Mighty ways. At St. Andrew's Bay, the lightship fought the sea until her moorings gave. Remember December 59, the howling wind and the driving rain. Remember the gallant men who drowned on the lifeboat of Mona. Captain signaled to the shore, must have help or we'll go down. From Brufty Ferry at 2 a.m. they sent the lifeboat Mona out. Remember December 59, the howling wind and the driving rain. Remember the gallant men who drowned on the lifeboat Mona was her name. Eight men formed that gallant crew. They set their boat against the main. The wind so hard and the sea so rough, we'll never see land nor home. Remember December 59, the howling wind and the driving rain. Remember the gallant men who drowned on the lifeboat Mona was her name. The hours went by and the Mona called. Wind blows hard and the seas run high. In the morning on Cornosti Beach, the Mona and her crew did lie. Remember December 59, the howling wind and the driving rain. Remember the gallant men who drowned on the lifeboat Mona was her name. Five lay drowned in the cabin there. Two were washed up on the shore. Eight men died when the boat capsized, and the eighth is lost forever. Remember December 59, the howling wind and the driving rain. Remember the gallant men who drowned on the lifeboat Mona was her name. Remember December 59, the howling wind and the driving rain. The men who leave the land behind, and the men who'll never see land again.
Julius Lester. I believe you're on the radio now.
Oh, hi, great. Well, just a few things, and I'll jump off. Hopefully I'll get on in the next few weeks and mention again about WJFF's anniversary. We're trying to follow your lead and put some archival material together. That would be February 12th. Maybe I could talk some of the folks from BAI to call in that evening. Solicit a anniversary wish or something. But anyway, one last thing on the gas drilling. There's a fellow that does look like Elmer Fudd who said, claims, we'll see a lot of local good-paying year-round jobs created once the training is available. The support industries such as restaurants, hotels, and housing will benefit also. Nice restaurants will spring up. People can afford to fix up their house or put in a swimming pool. I may have mentioned that before. What should be known is these guys.
What would you fill the swimming pool with?
What's that?
Fill the swimming pool with?
Have to buy distilled water from Red Apple or ShopRite. No, the fact is that most of these folks come from either Canada or down south. They come from Mexico, and they put them in containers, and they work 12 hours on and 12 hours off for a month, and then they bring in a fresh crew. These guys never see a motel room, unfortunately. From what I hear, working with these chemicals, they really do look like zombies, and there are investigations going on about heavy use of amphetamines. So anyway, that's that. I think that's all I've got. I'll jump off and listen to the show. Appreciate the doing. Thanks, Bob. Thanks really for
thank you, Fred.
For everything with this. I think it's made a big difference.
Yeah.
Take care.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the poet laureate of rock and roll, the voice of the prophets of the 60s counterculture. They have first spoke into the rock. Who dominated in the 70s and disappeared in the haze of substance abuse. Emerged to find Jesus. Was written off as a has-been by the end of the 80s and has suddenly shifted gears. Presenting some of the strongest music's career being in the late 90s. Ladies and gentlemen, Columbia recording artist, Bob Dylan.
I see in a store, man who live at school, will box out. I see in a store, man who live at school, will box out. Come on, tell me, baby, are your hippies under something like that? That man who live at school, will box out. You listen for him. And it's up on some time. I wanna see if it's really the expensive kind. Your balance is on your head like a mattress on the front of a wire.
time. When those who should have been stabbed. It was my best friend on my head. She sits there, and I had to live as good as my dad.
Give me a minute, I'll get it together.
just gotta pick myself up in the door. I'm waiting when you are, senor.
Listening to WBAI in New York City, or you're listening to KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska. You might be listening to CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. Perhaps it's WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, New York, or any number of other places on the World Wide Web, where Radio Unnameable is broadcast. Bill Propp and Robbie Barish are here with me this morning. My name's Bob Fass, and we have, well, perhaps one more half hour of this precious radio time before Ibrahim Gonzalez and maybe Ahmed Ali come in with In the Moment. So how shall we spend it? Shall we answer some of the 12 or so telephone calls that are struggling to get onto the air? Or shall we play some fine music while these earphones fall apart on my head? I can't really decide. Perhaps in the interests of participatory democracy, Robbie, Bill, you can vote as staff, and then maybe we'll have some people vote as listeners. What do you say?
Well, Bill likes to work the phone.
I do. Okay.
And I hate the phone. So that's one for and I guess one against. But I'll let him vote for himself.
I'm game for whatever the others want to
no,
do.
No, indecision
right now.
Indecision,
works, yeah.
Bill. Come on. You've got to take a stand. This
I
is
have
important.
Got a strong stand.
Well, let's get
maybe
the listeners vote.
Yeah.
Now, we have to, I mean, these people who call have to understand that they're not going to give their message to the world yet. All they're going to do is vote as to whether we have calls or music. The telephone number to call is 212-209-2900.
This week.
This week. You're on the air. What's your choice?
Well, I've been waiting on the line for a half hour to add to something that Fred had said, so I was told that I could do that. So I'm not just folding. I'm waiting.
Who told you that? Who told you that? Bill? Did Bill tell you that?
Bill Pops? Yes.
Bill Prop.
Yep.
Well, okay, there goes my plan for that that election. See?
I sabotaged it by default.
Well, you go ahead and say your piece.
Okay, and I'll be brief.
That's your vote, right? I can tell your vote.
Yeah, then I'm going to talk. Well, here's the thing. Fred had mentioned the Irish problem there, and if you want to, if anybody wants to find out more about it, and this I got off of the aforementioned program that Fred was talking about, the Irish program. It's Shell2Sea, S-H-E-L-L-T-O-S-E-A, Shell2Sea.com. And that site was put up by the good people of Broadhaven, and that's the little inlet in northwestern Ireland on the coast that's being besieged by the Shell people, and they've been having a lot of trouble there. So, but there's videos there and the whole explanation as to what's going on. Basically, Shell did this, I think, off the Nigerian coast, and there were 10 or 11 people that protested it. They were singled out, who were leaders of the protest, and they were summarily executed by the Nigerian government. So Shell got its way there and polluted those waters, and they're trying to pull the same thing in northwestern Ireland. So that's it. It's in County Mayo, by the way, Broadhaven, and you can see it right on the map there, right under Northern Ireland, and there's a little corner there. So that was one thing I wanted to say. The other thing is that...
Other thing? You only said there was one thing.
Oh, okay. Half hour I waited.
Go ahead.
Okay. State Senator John Bonachek, who's one of the people up here around Middletown, he's a good guy. So I wasn't surprised that he reversed his opinion on the whole natural gas question. But there is another state senator named Joseph Brodsky who actually introduced the bill banning MTBE in New York State. And I spoke to his aide, and his aide said that Senator Brodsky is well aware of the situation and that there are a whole plethora of votes, of bills in the New York State Senate, you know, restricting the natural gas companies, making them liable, and so on and so forth. So Brodsky's aide said, we're on it, and we're very well aware of what's going on. Okay, so that's it. I was going to talk a little bit about E15, which is another environmental issue, which will break your car if they do it. That's the EPA acting in a strange way, but I'll save that unless you want me to do that.
Oh, is that about putting 15% ethanol into gas?
Thank you, sir. Yes, and this is an issue, very quickly, where the oil companies and the environmental organizations are hand-in-hand, along with the automotive industry, against the EPA on this one. Because if they add 5% more ethanol, cars made before 2001 will start having catastrophic consequences in their engines. So you won't be able to drive, Bob, anymore, and neither will I in my old Jeeps and everything. So, no, it's really insane, and it's really a political thing to throw money to the way of the corn growers and Archer Daniels Midland. It makes no sense environmentally or for gasoline engines. It just ruins rubber parts releases the crud in engines, and then they break down. And even for new engines, this might happen. So, but they're insisting on going ahead on this, and you can call your legislators to question the EPA about that. The ERTEX, the information for this, is in Car and Driver, February 2010. For anybody who is a member of the AAA gets that every month. But it's Car and Travel, pardon me, Car and Travel, February 2010, AAA. And, yes, that's right, the E15 situation. But that will affect many, like a lot of people in New York State. We'll be getting horse and buggies if they do this stupid thing, which may be good, but who knows. That's it. I'm done. Now you can vote. Thank you, Bob.
Okay.
You're on the air.
Hello?
You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to briefly correct this, something about Howard Zinn. In fact, he has a full chapter in the People's History of the U.S. about enslaved white people in upstate New York, which is the site of, after Haiti, the second successful slave rebellion in history. It's a pretty amazing story, and it turned out, I asked my mother if our family had had anything to do with it, because I recalled that they were Dutch people living in that area at that time, and sure enough, it turned out her great-grandfather had barely escaped with his life, because he was one of the slave drivers on a big plantation up there. So Howard Zinn knew his stuff, and he covered everything.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye.
Take it easy.
Bye. You're on the air. You're on the air. Oh, he's developing followers.
Well, at least they're in the same key.
Yeah.
You're on the air.
Hey, Bobby.
Hey, Georgie.
How are you, man?
All right. How are you? How are things out in the Lake Michigan area?
Oh, lovely. Finally, the Wisconsin weather came back, and now it's like 9 degrees. It was 30 degrees for like a week and a half or 2 weeks. It was scary. But I just wanted to talk about the fracking, because, I mean, it's aptly named fracking, because everything it touches is fracked up. I mean, the people that work for the companies are fracked up. They're kept in boxes. That's nice. So it's slavery, making oil, or making gas, and then destroying the water so people can just drink dirty water. So it's slavery creating dirty water, creating billions of dollars. Say that again?
No, once is enough.
No, I thought somebody said something that was like, it's just so horrible to even think of that. This thing is even considered as a viable source of energy because of its incredible cost and impact on the neighborhoods. Do these people know that there's going to be diesel trucks flowing in and out every day? Thousands of trucks, thousands of gallons of diesel burning, smelling up the whole place, not to mention destroying the water of the aquifers and the water of the 11 million people in New York City. To consider this anywhere near sanity is, you know, punishable by, we should put them in the pillory. I think we should bring the pillory back. I mean, you know, for people that want to do things like this to the environment, to people, and to the water, and to the earth. They're, you know. Am I wrong?
I hear you. The pillory, huh?
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe it's better than prison. Prison is just a waste of money. But, and, you know, just, if they're found, you know, by a jury of their peers to be extremely guilty and foolish, they should get pilloried for a couple of days. But anyway, that's not what I'm really talking about. I'm like, oh, man. Okay, we're going to say something to the world, right? Hi, Alaska. Hi, Columbia, Canada. And, well, the world is talking to itself. That's good. The more we communicate, the more peace will be. So, I don't know, man. How do you stop the madness? I mean, money is not... Money is the cause of all these wars. People want money. That's like a pipeline through Afghanistan. Everyone wants it to... Again, it's the oil. The oil people are making war. What is this thing, man? That's not cool. It's very bad for the world. And we have so much sunlight, so much wind, so much water, so much... Come on, man. Oil. Can we do something else?
Oil belongs in the salad, not on the land, right? Well...
And it should be illegal. Please make fracking illegal. That's where it has to be. It has to be totally banned throughout the world. And anybody that wants this contract should be pilloried. You know? We could do better things with that money.
Let's see if we have any other people for fracking.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Stay warm, George. It's 7 degrees now there.
Something like that.
Can you actually walk on the lake when it's like this?
Well, some parts of it, yeah, at the edge of the water where it touches the sand, it makes these gigantic frozen waves that you just walk over. It's pretty beautiful and pretty amazing.
I would love to try that sometime. Yeah. I really would.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Okay.
Josh Fox, the guy who made the fracking movie, Gasland, he calls it. It used to be called Water Under Attack.
That's right.
But now it's Gasland, and it's at Sundance.
Yeah, it's late entry, and it's going to be considered. And this is the last, I think it ends tomorrow or over this weekend.
Really, yeah, but, you know, wow. So the planet you save may be your own, people.
It's the only one, only one we've got. Thanks a lot. Thanks, George.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. We take some more? Yeah, all right. PAI, you're on the air.
I want to follow up on the info that I was giving, talking about Ray before.
Oh, yeah, sure.
He did pay his December rent, which was $3,500. His super paid the $650 that Ray owed for his apartment, which he lives upstairs. And Ray just turned 77 on Monday. There was a party in his storefront, which I missed. Other than that, I want to read something really cute. Oh, here.
What was the change in his rent that forced him into this after 40 years of doing business in this place?
What was that?
What was the change in his rent that has forced this economic circumstance on him? I'm assuming that, you know, the $3,500 you're talking about was a change from some incredible
thing.
When his lease ran out after...
It's in the article here. I'd have to find it, but it was much lower when he first moved when he first opened in 1974.
Well, yeah, we know that, but I mean, nobody gets a 40-year lease. I mean, typically they renew them.
Since it's a commercial lease, it's not subject to any kind of rent regulation that I know of.
Typically they range in terms from 7 to 10 years. Right. So the question is, what was it 10 right. years ago compared to now?
Oh, it's in here somewhere, and I don't
Well,
have
all right,
it.
I'm not going to...
Well, BAI has an escalator clause, you know. We may have a 10-year lease, but written into that, it skyrocketed, which is not to totally explain why we're in such dire financial straits. But we'll be looking for a new place, too, so if anybody has a place out there.
Well, he's
like an old church.
There's other good news in the race situation, and that is the Leshko family that owned Leshko's restaurant before they went out of business, according to an acquaintance that I know, a well-known acquaintance on Avenue A, they're in negotiation with Ray right now, because according to him, they don't want to throw him out. They've had a 40-year relationship with him, and you know, they've known him for 40 years, and he's been there since 1974, so they don't want to throw him out. So they're going, they're negotiating with him, and we know somebody that's probably right in the middle of that right now as I speak.
Well, if they're the landlord, it can be a pretty one-sided negotiation, which is sort of, we love you, we want to keep you, how much can you pay?
Yeah.
End of story. Here's the deal, you know.
But according to my acquaintance, who's a well-known photographer on the Lower East Side, who did photograph for the Villager at one time.
I think I know the photographer.
That's all I know. He said they're in negotiation with him. What that means exactly is anybody's guess. But he said it's good news. And so I have to take it as good news.
Okay.
And the other quickie is there are two little kids I'm going to read up to something and then I'll get off very quickly. Oh, okay. Where is it? I just had it.
I hate when that happens.
God's precious air time.
God doesn't exist. Oh, it's better than an East Village activist called out to passersby to save Ray's and buy some Belgian fries to help him out. Two young Ray fans got the steady beat with a tambourine and shaker stick, whatever that is. That's what they usually get at Ray's candy store. Matthew Laird, 8, said, well, we maybe get ice cream. Hot fudge sundae, added his brother Ethan Laird, 6. And yesterday we got a root beer float, Matthew recalled. That's for how long they've been eating Alvarez's treats, that's Ray's last name. Matthew said, since we were born, since we were allowed to eat ice cream. That's it.
Okay.
All right.
Now you got me hungry for ice cream. Take a few more? Oh. The unlord.
Yeah, what about the vote?
Oh, yeah, that's right. It started out as a vote.
Yeah.
That's right. And I didn't have the heart to have somebody simply cast a vote who was hanging on for half an hour. Well, let's see what happens. Okay, do you want to vote or did you want to make a comment? You're on the air.
Yeah, I want to talk about the situation in Iran right now. The kids were executed yesterday.
Oh, yes.
Yes, the student leaders were executed in Iran. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you go on, I don't want to say where on the Internet because I don't want to get anybody in trouble. The Iranian young people, and there's a lot of young people in Iran, 60% of them are under 30. They are praising Bush for the liberation of Iraq, and they're asking for the troops to come in and liberate them. And the neocons had predicted that would happen. And the disaster that we face with our situation now is that Obama totally doesn't get that. And these kids are dying, man. They're being slaughtered. And they're begging us. And if you go on the Internet, I don't want to say where because I don't want the authorities over there to know. But I'm in communication with people over there. And it's a really sad situation because exactly what was predicted when we took out the biggest bully on the block, Saddam, the young people over there want freedom. And they're dying for it. And our leader here doesn't want to get involved. Our Obamatola here. He doesn't want to get it. He doesn't want to meddle. You know, doesn't want to meddle in their affairs. Isn't that sad?
Generally, I think that's a good idea. If George Bush hadn't meddled in their affairs, there'd be a lot more people alive in that country.
Well,
and I don't know about Saddam.
Well, let me ask you a question.
On the block.
5 elections from now in 20 years, when Iraq is a successful democracy, won't you people look foolish? And when the trial is here, and these guys are banging their chests about what they did. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
How many years from now?
20 years from now.
Let's see, 20 years from now, I'll be 97. Yeah, I guess.
But, Bob, I do want to say one thing to you. Your voice, I was listening to it earlier tonight on the tape from before. Your voice is like a fine wine. It gets better with time. I got to say, you have the best voice on the radio, man. I disagree with a lot of your politics, but I love listening to you, man. You've got a great voice. And you're a great guy. I just think that a lot of times the left just misses the point, that the big picture, which is that these kids are being killed because they want the freedoms that we take for granted.
Is this alcohol one?
We take our freedoms for granted. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, what is? I mean, aren't there kids being killed in this country? Aren't there people in this country who are
starving?
Would
you compare what we live under to what they live under, Bob?
Yeah, but
come on.
But that's.
Come on, this is what, come on.
Insofar as it's our fault, we ought to do something about it. But, you know, it's more responsible to take care of the people.
Well, let me
country.
Ask you a question, and this is what Sarah Palin was saying today, how sad this is.
Because I want to hear this.
Sarah Palin was saying that when she, and in the first debate with Obama, she's going to say, listen, when you went to the Berlin Wall, I knew we were in trouble from the very beginning with you. When you went to the Berlin Wall, what an image that was to see you while the ovens of Auschwitz still smoldered and General Zhukov wanted to turn Germany into dust. he said, his own words,
the,
is dust. Okay?
I'm trying to make my point. You said you wanted to hear it. I'm not so sure now.
Okay, well, yeah. Because
the ovens of Auschwitz,
the same
smolder?
Democracy that we built for Germany, these ungrateful Germans today, we're trying to do in the Middle East now. And the Germans, you know how they are towards this war. They when they send troops to Afghanistan, they refuse to fight. They only work in the kitchen. Imagine having a German cook. I mean, I'd rather have a Taliban cook. So what I'm saying is, when she points out that we could have handed them over to Russia for just revenge. The reason the Cold War started was because we withheld, we protected West Germany. Yeah, the Cold War started because we didn't let Russia do what it wanted to do, which was take it what it was rightfully theirs.
I thought that the Cold War started because in 1917 they tried to put a sanitary cordon around the Soviet Union. I thought that's.
The Cold War started because the Russians wanted what was theirs at the end of the war. The Americans came in late in the game.
I think it started a little earlier.
The Russians lost 20 million people, and they resented the fact that Eisenhower was telling them how far they could go. They wanted to turn Germany into dust. That was Zhukov's words, dust. And they were rightfully so to feel that way, weren't they? But we stopped that, built a democracy. And we're trying to do the same thing in the Middle East. Where's the pay-it-forward concept? The Germans are demonstrating how ungrateful they are. And here, and let me tell you the irony of ironies, though. In 50 years, when Eurabia, when the Germans are living under that whip hand, and America will be Disneyland because we'll be Latino, they're sexy, we'll marry together, the Muslims are going to rule Europe, okay? And then they're going to realize Bush was a genius.
Okay.
Then they're going to realize.
I can hardly wait. Then they're going to realize how stupid. And Sarah Palin is another genius.
Well, we're going to
you're three of them.
But it's true. Think
well, this program's going to go out on a really high note here, you know.
You're on the radio. Hi.
Hi, am I in the air?
Yes, you are. It's Bill Weinberg.
Yes, it is. I won't take very much of your time, Bob, but I absolutely have to respond to that last caller. I don't know what website he was looking at, but I've been following the opposition movements in Iran very, very closely, as you know, and I support them with certain criticisms. But I can tell you this, that all of their leadership is wholeheartedly opposed to any kind of U.S. or Israeli military intervention in Iran.
But
case closed.
Yes, but the caller wasn't.
The caller wasn't what?
Opposed.
Well, that's quite obvious, yes, but I'm just correcting him on a factual inaccuracy.
Well,
carry on. Thank you very much.
Oh, carry on yourself. You're on the air. And it's you.
Yes, I have some notes on C.L.R. James.
Oh, I wish you had called a little earlier. There's only 4 minutes left in the program. But,
next week, then.
There's room for one note. Next week is the marathon.
This is
Gary from Staten Island, huh?
Notorious. Well, yeah. C.R. James was born January 4th, 1901 in Trinidad. In 1918, James received his teaching certificate from Queen's Royal College. One of his pupils, Eric Williams, was later the first Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago. During the 1930s and after World War II, he covered cricket for the Manchester Guardian. In 1938, James came to the United States, but he was deported 15 years later during the McCarthy era. While interned on Ellis Island, James wrote Mariners, Renegades, and Castaways, the story of Herman Melville and the world we live in, 1953. His other books include Minty Alley, 1927, World Revolution, 1937, History of Negro Revolt, 1977. Notes on Dialectics, 1980.
Gary.
Yes.
Can you give us one significant fact that typifies his contribution to our knowledge, rather than these biographical facts that don't really sum up the man? Yeah, I'm saying, why is he important to you?
Well, because of his book, Black Jacobins, with the situation in Haiti, it's regarded as the first Third World Revolution, the Haitian Revolution of Brian Hansen.
That's right.
Yeah. And there you have it. I know you're pressed for time, so there you go.
All right. Peace out.
That's a song I've always wanted to hear Joan Baez sing.
Maybe she will. She will.
She will. It's a song I think she could do well with.
She has a new record soon, doesn't she? She's due for a new record.
Her records usually only come out in the fall.
Mm.
One a year. Just one.
Well, fall, to be honest, again. This is a particularly boring part of a conversation I had with Julius Lester
in
1966. I don't know why you're playing it now, Bill, but...
I was queued up, that's where I was. I'm sorry. I had known.
Let it go until...
I was saying it with guitar.
Let it go until Ibrahim comes in, because I'm sure it has to get better.
I am a roving rambler, a fitter.
It's better.
There you go. I can fix you anything, a camshaft to a spade. I can fix a dodgy gear box or mend a broken tread. DeCoco Leyland engine.